On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, January 12th, the Urine Trouble America edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. And in New York, we have Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
And I understand there's a man with you there.
A man in the room.
There's a man in the room. David Wallace Wells, deputy editor of New York Magazine, who's going to be June today. Are you up to the task, David?
I'm going to try. I don't think I can pull off the accent, but, in all other ways, I will do it.
Yes. Okay. Why did we invite a man on today, Noreen?
I was wondering the same thing, so I'm curious what you guys...
Well, we are talking about some male-ish topics.
And we needed the views of a man. We're actually going to have a second man, also named David, join us later in the hour, because all men are named David.
Well, and David, this David is my coworker, and it's kind of fun. He's a longtime listener to the podcast, so it's kind of fun.
I would say that I work more with Noreen on GChat, actually, than at New York Magazine.
I feel great having David on because I know that you know the show intimately. He's a man fan of the XX Gabfest.
I'm listening for years. So excited to be here.
Okay, so before we get started, I want to, because our listeners have been so loyally giving us substitutes for guys, the word guys, which we weren't that into.
Yes.
So I collected them. Some of them are obvious, like y'all and friends, comrades. That's one I haven't heard in a while.
Wait, was the objection of your listeners that guys was too gendered and you were using it to refer to women too?
It was a question that someone asked us. Is it sexist to use guys and why do we use it all the time? And it was just wondering about the phrase guys. Like you walk in a room and you say, hey guys, is that sexist? Because it's just yet another assumption that the male is the default.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the question. Someone said guys plus gals equals gulls. That's not going to stick. That's not going to stick. But here's the best one, which came from Dr. Michelle Mendelsohn. I think this one solves all of our problems. She was quoting a book called Gender Shifts in the History of English by Anne Curzon, a linguist. And she says that guys actually was originally used to mean women or something else. Like it referred to a strangely dressed person. Like in Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, Meg says, "You shall not make a guy of yourself." And then Joe replies, I don't mind being a guy if I'm comfortable." And she concludes that the shift of guy to mean men is like a late phenomenon. So it was early kind of gender neutral. Is that good enough for you guys?
I love it. And can I?
Is it good enough for you guys?
Can I defend? Because I was specifically called out for my use of guys. Can I defend my use, which I found out over Christmas is actually a regionalism? My parents bought my brother-in-law, who's from Boston, a book called How to Speak Midwestern. And I was paging through it. And guys is specifically called out as a Midwestern term of like use more than other regions. So I am just speaking my authentic, truest self when I call you guys guys.
Okay, good. Gulls. Thanks, gulls. all right, our topics for today. First, it's even hard to say, the golden showers. What do we call this? The new possibly real, possibly fake document revealing just hard to forget things about Donald Trump.
The piss poor state of our country, or Watergate.
The piss poor state of our country. There's going to be so many puns in that segment. It's going to be hard to stand.
It's going to be golden.
Stop. The Rockettes, a little scandalette breaks out about whether or not they should dance at the inauguration. And then chatbots, why are they all female, even when we try and pretend that they have no gender? Our Slate Plus segment this week for our wonderful Slate Plus supporters is Mario sexist? Mario, the video game, that is. Should you let your daughters play Mario? Is it sexist? Okay, let's start with Trump.
How could you start with anything else? This is really...
How could you start with anything else? Do you think we're going to have to start with Trump every week? So there's always some...
Every day,
gender-y
I feel like.
Scandal. Yeah, every day. Okay, so this is a somewhat complicated scandal. We should start it by pointing out there was a document that was published that revealed many things about Trump, supposedly by a British spy who had gotten anonymous Russian sources who suggested some things that were actually pretty serious, like Trump was coordinating with the Russians on intelligence and that he knew about the DNC leak as it was happening. The DNC leak. And then the thing that I'm afraid we're probably going to spend too much time talking about is who wants to do it? Who wants to describe it? Noreen, you want to describe it?
Describe the compromat?
Yeah.
The compromat, as it was called.
In 2013, Donald Trump took a trip to Moscow, and he stayed, this is all legend, blanket alleged.
It's not legend. It's not legend. We should say what it is, because so many respectable journalistic institutions chose not to publish this document, which has been around for a while. We should preface it with that before you get the details into everybody's brain who hasn't read it.
I said alleged, not legends.
Alleged, right, yes. Right, alleged. Yes. We'll talk at the end of the segment about like how much believability we should give this thing.
Right.
But go ahead, just describe what it says.
Well, according to this document that BuzzFeed published, Donald Trump was in Moscow in 2013 and stayed at the Ritz-Carlton. And I guess specially requested to stay in the room that Barack and Michelle Obama had stayed in Moscow. And then, David, correct me if I'm wrong, but had Russian prostitutes brought to him in that room and asked them to urinate on each other, I believe in or near the bed that Barack and Michelle Obama had slept in.
As somebody pointed out on Twitter, it would be like, you just imagine the people who are sleeping in that suite, like waking up this morning in that bed.
That they paid like $1,200 for.
$1,200, probably like $12,000.
Yeah.
Now, part of the reason we invited you on, David, is because, you know, you for so long were helming the Sex Lives podcast, so we thought you could maybe give us
insight about golden showers. One thing that's interesting to me about this is that he does not, at least according to this particular report, does not seem to have been involved in the peeing directly or in like a directly sexual way. He was just staging a little show of peeing, which he was observing from a distance. Now, like, who knows? Maybe it's just like the weird grammar of this report. And there are a lot of typos and stuff that people have noted already that call its authenticity into question. But
and the report, by the way, can we just quickly say, was an opposition research report hired by Never Trump. The M16 officer was hired by Never Trump people. Okay, go back to Golden
But
Towers.
Every news report says the M16 officer who was British is a legit M16 officer relying on anonymous Russian sources to create an OPPA research document. So that's just so ambiguous, possibly good reliable information, possibly just completely not
true. Isn't it MI6?
I don't know. I haven't watched Bond in a long time. You're probably right.
Well, just but to back up a little more. Sorry, I feel like we led with the golden showers, and we're like backing all the way up to like the Cold War. But it is the case that Trump himself and Obama were both briefed, I think yesterday, on the fact that that the intelligence community believes that the Kremlin does have compromising information about the president-elect. So I don't totally know if that meant that the report that we all read last night is the information that they were talking about, or whether it's just a report that BuzzFeed decided to publish because it could conceivably have been that information.
Back to
Golden Showers. I guess we'll find out soon. What did you say?
We interrupted him midstream.
You're good, Noreen. You're
this is
good.
Like my favorite activity.
One of the things that's amazing about this report, you mentioned the grammar, David, is the truthiness of it. That if you were going to make up a little sexual scandal about Trump, this would be exactly the right one. It seems true, right? So for one thing, it says in the report, he hired the suite where he knew President and Mrs. Obama, and then it says in parentheses, whom he hated. Right. Which is something we all know. But like a British a British officer would, that's exactly how he would put it, you know, something so completely obvious to the rest of us. The other thing is that it's like fetishy in exactly the right Trump way. It's a show put on for him. It's degrading to them. It's a performance for his pleasure. It's like people debasing themselves for him. And he seems to be getting like not actual, like immediate sexual pleasure from it. It's like a distant show, which don't you guys think that's in keeping with what we know of his, you know,
I was sort of going to ask you the same thing, whether you guys think of him as being a sexual being or someone who just sort of operates through sex on a sort of power basis.
Well, which this is, right? This is.
But which one is he, do you think, Noreen?
You know, I don't have intimate knowledge of Donald Trump. And what I have heard about him, you know, the grab him by the pussy stuff, seems like the power thing is huge for him.
Yeah, it feels all power to me. Like that was always my theory about why people were not as turned off by Bill Clinton as they were by Trump. Like somehow, even though they both did similar things, people and women, I guess, felt that Clinton liked women.
He was a seducer at heart, where Trump was.
Yeah, he was a seducer at heart. Exactly, exactly. There's just like he has no interest in women fundamentally. Trump.
It's been really you've probably seen these interviews too, where he talks about his wives, or maybe just one of his wives, where he says he sort of loses interest in them once he makes them into stars, which is just such a distant way of looking at a woman that, like, that you're married to, but also that you're like sleeping with, that it's really like it's really not about any kind of intimate connection with him.
So in some ways, I am more interested in the reaction to this news than in pondering what it means about Trump's psyche. So we don't know if it's true. If you were trying to engineer something to make the liberal media piss themselves, it would be this, right? We can't resist making jokes. It's like that. It's that too good to check kind of impulse. Like, of course, Donald Trump likes golden showers. You know, everyone was so excited about and horrified and sad and embarrassed for America. But also, it just felt like if someone were trying to embarrass America even more, you know, our Puritan roots are coming out in all kinds of crazy ways right now. I mean, also just the idea that, you know, someone who is – there are numerous accusations of, you know, sexual assault against this man, and that did not stop him from winning the presidency. But, you know, asking two women to pee on each other would? Like, what does that say about America, you know?
But I don't think it would. That's a Democrat – that's like a Hillary fantasy, you know? Hillary's press people or whoever it was, a Hillary ally tweeting, you know, oh, this – you know, the press knew about this before the election and they didn't publish it. It wouldn't have made a difference. It's not necessarily that credible a report. What does it necessarily tell us about Trump that we don't already know?
He would have been embarrassed enough to not do it. Like, so what does it say about Trump that he thought that this information was compromising enough that he would, you know, allegedly sell his soul to the Russians for it?
Well, I don't know if that's – do you think that's what's being alleged? It's sort of unclear exactly what kind of cooperation they're suggesting is going on and on what basis. But I do think that Trump is like an amazing case study in post-shame politics. And I he's been tweeting since this came out saying that it's all lies and a total witch hunt, et cetera. But I also think that if it did come out, he'd sort of like find a way forward. I don't think he's the kind of person who would retreat from anything. And it's interesting to think about him in the line of like politicians who have experienced sexual shame, even in the relatively recent past, and how he's just such a completely different kind of figure, totally, in my mind anyway.
Can
totally
you say more? What do you mean by post-shame politics? Like that this isn't a source of shame anymore? That, you know, he can be, the scandal after scandal can come out about him and it doesn't have a whiff of scandal. It doesn't derail him. It just becomes a joke or something we play around with, but not something that actually is a stain on him?
Well, I think there's sort of two timelines. One is like for all other politicians, and then there's like the fact of Trump as an outlier from that tradition. But I think generally that the advice that we would give to a politician who caught in a sex scandal now would be just like grin and bear it, wait it out, and you'll survive on the other side. And the only thing that would make someone, like Anthony Weiner, disappear in shame is that he retreated from office in shame.
Then he ran for mayor. So yeah. He didn't totally.
But we're moving towards post-shame politics is what you're saying.
Like, and that Trump is towards... like, yeah, totally. And Trump is somebody who, I mean, there's so little distance between his public image and his public image is so grotesque already that there's nothing that would meaningfully damage or distort it.
Well, okay. So who is the politician who said the only things that can damage me are a dead woman or a live boy? I don't remember who it was, but do we think that the rule still holds true? Is that like, I mean, obviously that's extraordinarily crass. Okay, so our super intern Daniel just told us it's Edwin Edwards, who I believe is still active in Louisiana politics.
I don't think that's true. I think David's right that we're moving more towards that position, but that people have been damaged by sexual scandals in the very recent past. I'm just wondering if this post-shame politics is better for women, you know?
Well, does it...
Like, if we move into a world where we care less about these things, we care less about people's personal lives, what they do, how they are. You know, I'm thinking of my favorite...
Crystal Ball.
22-year-old. Exactly. Crystal Ball, who I bring up at every occasion. Crystal Ball, who was, you know, shamed by her Facebook pictures of her with whatever, like a dildo on her nose. If we move towards a world where nobody cares, is that better? Is that a favor Trump is doing us?
That assumes that the same standard would be applied to women. And I just don't think it would be. I don't think that post-shame politics will exist for women.
What do you think, David? Is post-shame politics good?
Well, I think...
Do we want that?
I think generally, yeah, probably it's better to not, try to enforce sexual morality on people. And I think better if the way that we build healthy sexual relationships is not through shame, which is kind of a destructive force, I think, in most cases. On the other hand, you know, the country would be better off if Donald Trump had a little more shame and experienced... some of the things that he should be ashamed of with shame. So
now you sound Puritan.
Yeah, I mean, well, I have a reactionary core.
That makes you American.
On the social level, I think generally it's good, but it also enables some monsters to be monstrous without having to pay for it.
I think there's a difference between America having less shame around sexuality and like a sort of like Caligula state that our government appears to be moving into. Like, that's all I can think about when I think about the Donald Trump presidency is just like the ancients, you know, and the way those empires fell. And there was a lot of, there's a lot of decadence in there.
Yeah, and this scandal, that's another reason I think it's stick. You know, some things stick even if they're not like John. I always think of John Edwards' haircut in this moment. Mm-hmm. Like, if somebody else had a $400 haircut, who cares? But the $400 haircut in his case just seemed to just capture everything about him. And maybe that's true about this one, too. Like, Caligula in his bed with Russian prostitutes peeing on the bed. And, you know, the bed is gilded and there are people outside the door serving him with, you know, fruits and pouring grapes in his mouth. Like, it's just so – it's too perfect.
And you look at those photos of his residence and it's like his apartment is like a jar of urine. This is like – right.
The showers are golden in Donald Trump's
apartment. Hair, his skin, it's like he's a fetishist for sure. He's a gold fetishist. The prostitutes must be dehydrated.
Spraying urine around the house just to give it the right hue.
Marilyn jumping in from the other side of the studio wall. How sad would it be if this is what brings him down and not the fact that he sexually assaulted women?
Right.
Although I considered this is a form of sexual, like this is sort of a piece, like, no?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, an idea of what David was talking around shame and sexual freedom. Like, the argument can be made if a woman is choosing to be a sex worker and she decides to do this for money, then that's an equal exchange of services. Whereas when he grabs women, by the pussy and brags about it, that is something he totally should feel shame for. But now this is what ultimately distracts us from everything else. And the fact that he's going to be our president as a sexual assault.
Yeah, what's screwed up is that, like, this is, okay, so this is outside our sexual norm, people peeing on each other. But a guy assaulting a woman somewhere along that scale is apparently not for a lot of people. That's kind of what it boils down to, right?
Right. Okay, so let's wind this down in two ways. One is, what are people looking out for in the next few days? You know, obviously there are news organizations desperately trying to pin down these various allegations, although they have been trying to do this for a while. So maybe we'll find out something more. The more serious allegations, which, forgive us, listeners, we haven't really gotten into, but somebody else will, about how much Trump colluded with the Russians. And then, I mean, do the journalistic ones interest you? Like, what do you think, David, as a sort of like high editor there? Like, would you guys have published this? Like, is that a debate that we need to have? Was it reasonable for BuzzFeed to publish this? I mean, just all the various things around this document.
Well, it's interesting that apparently this document was sort of circulating for several months. David Corn wrote a big piece off of it in Mother Jones before the election, although he sort of elided some details. And I mean, I've heard from many journalists who are very far from like the political press who had seen it. And everybody had universally neglected to publish it, which is, it's interesting to think about in contrast to the sort of right wing media underbelly. There are just a lot more places on the right where something like this could have circulated profitably. And especially, I think, this is something other people have said on Twitter last night, but especially post-Gawker, it seems like there's not really a kind of a place on the left for surfacing questionable material. When BuzzFeed published it, they did have a note introducing it saying there are many reasons to doubt the veracity of this report. Personally, that would have meant, for me, that means I wouldn't have wanted to publish it if I really doubted it more than I believed in it. But I also think that, you know, just from a sort of tribal partisan point of view, I do want to think that there is an outlet for rumor mongering about the right to match the outlets for rumor mongering about the left on the right.
Oh, I found it so irresponsible at BuzzFeed, and it came right on the heels of a CNN story that, you know, had been corroborated, had been sort of checked in a way that felt like responsible journalism. And then the BuzzFeed thing, the real information that it had that moved the ball forward was like the pissing thing. And no one now is talking about the collusion. Everyone's just making jokes about urine. And I think that's pretty bad. And what did BuzzFeed get out of it? They got a lot of page views. And
I can't believe you just said in that like serious, scoldy voice, everyone's making jokes about urine. It's like,
we're about to do that. Right?
I can't hold it in anymore, Hannah.
But it's also interesting to think about how much this is going to take over his press conference, which is a sort of like he hasn't faced the press directly in like 6 or 8 months scheduled for today. They're not going to ask you about anything else. So there's a way in which you can think of it as like, you know, a Donald Trump operation, like that this gets him out of answering questions about
real things.
Yeah.
And we journalists who by many Trump voters are presumed to be on the left look ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And instead, he just gets to talk about his orgies, which is like he's probably excited to do that.
Yeah, we should. The news is
now. I feel guilty. Now I feel guilty about. We can't do. Were we allowed to do the puns, or we're not allowed to do the puns, the best puns?
No, let's do it. It's my favorite was yellow journalism.
Yellow journalism. That's first on my list. That's so good. But someone else wrote, we should bring back trumped up trickle down. Remember that terrible phrase of Hillary's? Like, maybe that wasn't such a bad phrase after all. That was pretty good. Trump Watergate. That's pretty good.
Watergate. What else?
You had a WikiLeaks one, David.
Icky Leaks. That wasn't so good.
All right,
good,
that's enough. It wasn't so good.
I liked
good,
Golden
but that's okay.
Gate. It's, but that looks better in print. Than,
All right, listeners, if you want to indulge us and yourselves, you can send us in your favorite puns for the Golden Shower scandal, and we will refer to it by that from now on, or maybe never again, if this all proves to be ridiculous. Let's move on to our next topic, the Rockettes. So last week we found out the Rockettes of Radio City Music Hall fame were asked to dance at the inauguration. This was an exclusive scoop by Marie Claire. They revealed details of a meeting where this was discussed, and then some of the Rockettes balked on Twitter, Facebook, and elsewhere. And then it was decided they didn't have to dance at the inauguration. So now we discuss, is that okay? Should they have been allowed to rebel? And how did they suddenly become the new feminist heroines? For this discussion, we invite on David Plotz, CEO of Atlas Obscura, host of the Political Gabfest, and my husband. And we invite him on because we had a fight about this. David, it is true. David is in a room on a cell phone, so he's going to sound a little echoey. But David, welcome to the show.
Hi, sweetie. I haven't seen you in days.
That's true. We've been in different cities. That's maybe why we had a fight about it. If we'd been sitting in the same room, we could have made up, but we didn't. So we'll take it to the airwaves because that's good. That's good to make it bigger and bigger. Okay, so maybe I won't start with David. Noreen, do you want to say a little bit more about what the objections of the Rockettes were for our listeners? Like, why didn't they want to dance at the inauguration and how annoyed were they about it?
Well, I think their objections were the same ones that a lot of us might have had if we were asked to participate in the inauguration of Donald Trump. I think it felt for them outside the bounds of normal that this was a man who, you know, in order to get elected, had certainly relied on racist tropes, had a history of being pretty horrible towards women, and many of them just didn't want to be complicit in that.
Yeah, and the thing I liked is they just, one of them said, you know, given our uniforms, we just didn't want to stand around him. I thought that was a pretty effective argument. Yeah. That kind of stuck with me. Like, that made some sense, you know? Okay, David, go at it. What is your argument is just that they should have, that they didn't have any right to object. They shouldn't have objected. They have no business saying no.
Well, I appreciate you not characterizing my argument, Hannah, before I make it. First of all, I would point out that the Rockettes, as an organization, did not let in an African-American until 1987. So as an institution, it's not one of the great progressive institutions of American life, but we'll let that pass. I think it is the right of any individual artist who's asked to participate in the inauguration or any event. It is your right of conscience not to participate. Being a Rockette is different. Being a Rockette is being the employee of a corporation in this case being Madison Square Garden, although it's sort of slightly, the corporate ownership is slightly complicated, but it's simple enough to say it's owned by Madison Square Garden. You are an entity, you're part of an entity, you're an ant-like part of an entity, which is much bigger than you, that predates you, that you had no part in the artistic creation of, which you have no control over the artistic presentation of. You are an employee the same way that someone who works at McDonald's is an employee at McDonald's, and as such, you, if you want to choose to remain employed by this entity, you do the things the entity requires. As long as they're not requiring you to do things that are against the law, then it's your obligation as an employee more or less to do them. If you don't want to do them, you can quit. And I don't think we want to be in a situation where anybody can claim sort of for artistic reasons that they don't want to do something. When really it's just basically doing their job. And the analogy I would make.
Oh my God, spoken like a CEO, spoken like a CEO.
The analogy that I would make to you, is that I heard a ton of people angry when cake decorators and florists didn't want to, because of their own moral principles, didn't want to make, bouquets or cakes for weddings of gay people. And this was a huge cause on the right. And people on the left were like, no, you do your job. You go ahead and do your job. You're not part of it. Your participation, your making of the cake is not an endorsement of it. It doesn't violate your moral values. Everyone knows you're simply a you're performing a service for that wedding. But, and you have no kind of moral right not to participate in it. And I feel much the same way about this Trump thing. No one thinks that a Rockette who dances at the inauguration has made that choice volitionally to say, like, this is me endorsing Donald Trump. Everyone who sees that knows that Rockette is an employee of a company, and she's doing it because the company has decided she's going to do it.
Well,
I mean, I do think we should probably at some point talk about the nature of those contracts, which do seem pretty exploitative. And I'm not sure that it's super fair to think of those dancers as empowered employees. But what interests me about the story more generally is sort of how contemporary it feels. So, you know, as David was saying, the Rockettes are like an institution. They've been around for a long time. Political protests, obviously, people have been doing for a long time. But there's something about this particular objection that feels very like Obama era. And I think it has to do with the fact that we've seen sort of simultaneously a revolution in identity rights over the last 10 or 15 years, and people really, really asserting identity as like a core value which cannot be interfered with. It should not be interfered with. And then simultaneously, like the rise of partisanship as an identity. And so I think these women are feeling like it is equivalent to being told to turn off their ethnicity or their gender if they're asked to essentially turn off their partisanship.
Or not partisanship, but just sense of right and wrong.
Yeah.
Well, one question to answer is this about politics or is this about sexual harassment? So it sort of crosses the line. They're essentially alleging a hostile environment, that this creates a hostile environment in their workplace. Secondly, I would say, you know, you have there's no question about whether they can do this. They really can't do this because American workers have absolutely no protection. Like if you can, in 1 second, you can find like a sheriff, you know, you can be fired because as an employee, you didn't go to the political rally that your boss supported. Supports, or because you had, you know, a Hillary bumper sticker on your car. Like employers can fire you basically for anything, and workers, especially in a contract environment like the one that the Rockettes work in, have no rights. You know, so we know they can't. The question is, do we want to support a world in which workers aren't allowed to object to not something they just find like politically unpleasant or that they disagree with, but which they feel personally sort of assaulted and harassed by, the idea of standing behind somebody who has a history of walking into dressing rooms of people who are dressed just like them and ogling them naked. So there is that problem. As for the gay cake makers, like, I don't, you know, of course, if you believe the Rockettes are right, you have to also believe that somebody who doesn't believe in gay marriage shouldn't be required to make a cake topping for a gay couple. They should be allowed to refuse them and send them to the next cake maker.
But isn't that also, I mean, isn't the equivalent refusing service to a black person at a lunch counter? I mean, isn't that what those laws are designed to?
Yeah, I guess they are. I guess, yeah, you're right. Okay, so what do we do about that?
Well, yeah, Rockettes are not a protected class in, you know, American case law.
But sexual harassment is protected. Like, hostile environment is protected.
That's a ludicrous claim. It is ludicrous.
What's a ludicrous claim?
That performing at Donald Trump's inauguration is a hostile work environment because Donald Trump.
What?
I'm sure
it's absolutely.
Donald
he's
Trump,
got. A, he's
Donald
got a history
Trump is
of
a
doing
sexual harasser. Donald Trump is a sexual harasser and a sexual predator. But the idea that merely performing at something where there are thousands of performers, a billion cameras, and the public eye of everything, it constitutes a hostile work environment is insane. This is by this standard. By this
What's
standard,
a hostile?
Who,
there's a
any,
you know you're
any,
confusing
by this standard,
sexual.
Any, anyone in the Secret Service. That no woman employee of the Secret Service should have to, you know, serve in the Trump White House. No woman who works in the White House kitchen should have to do her job because Donald Trump is, you know,
no, that's not the same.
From there.
That's not the same. Sexual harassment is not the same as hostile work environment. So hostile work environment is more like, you know, naked lady calendars or going to a strip club. So they can claim there's an exact corollary to what to a situation like it's the Miss America corollary. It's not that, you know, just a woman shouldn't be near Trump because he might grab her. It's that these scantily clad women who look like Miss America contestants don't want to be done onto them what he has habitually and consistently done to women who are dressed and look like them.
Miss Universe, I think.
But that's a really far-fetched claim. That's like a anticipating a wounding through a very long telescope.
What about the feeling that they have that they are essentially being turned into symbols of white supremacy, right? So there are not a lot of women of color in the Rockettes, but there are some, and they chose not to. They opted out of this for pretty obvious reasons. And so, as the woman who spoke to Marie Claire said, it's 18 white girls up there, you know, that like kicking our legs in patriotic uniforms. People online are saying that we look like Nazis. How does it feel if you all of a sudden, just by doing your job, are turned into an odd kitsch symbol of this nascent American fascism?
I think they sort of already were. That's like why Trump wanted them as inauguration. That's what the Rockettes stand for, really.
I mean, they wear costumes that are designed to make them seem shiny and all of the same color to begin with. So there are non-white Rockettes, but their legs are already masked in such a way that they appear uniform. And I don't, to your point earlier, David, about exploitative contracts, thousands of women want to be Rockettes. It's a job that is massively desired. It's a job that lots of people want and seek, and it is not, they're not being asked to perform criminal acts. They're being compensated fairly and according to the market. You know, they are allowed to negotiate about their working conditions. I don't feel like that they're in any strong position to claim that they're some deeply oppressed class of people who are only, you know, making this last desperate stand against the oppressor.
But this is what happened to stewardesses.
Stewardesses are one example. I guess cheerleaders these days are another example. I feel like there's an emerging sort of
rebellion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like rebellion against the idea of anonymous women designed to look a certain way for a certain purpose. Like stewardesses were important in the early feminist history because there was a natural assumption that they should be in service to rich businessmen and that they had to look a certain way and act a certain way, and they had to check their entire personality, politics, everything at the door. And there was an assumption that the men could say anything to them. And it's a little bit like that with the Rockettes. Like, we don't want to live in a world in which, you know, working in one of these jobs means that you have to be a completely blank, pleasing entity. You don't necessarily. Yeah, you're allowed to have,
totally,
you know, little
agree.
Expressions of personality.
I totally know when you're a Rockette, you don't. Like, that's the point. The point is that it's a
how come
it's
when
a
you're a stewardess,
line.
You don't.
It's a kick line.
But we used to think this about stewardesses.
Stewardess
we used to think they had to be glamorous and pretty, and then the world changed.
No. The David, stewardess is different. A stewardess is the job of a stewardess is to bring safety and order to a dangerous environment. And that.
And like the
that,
job of a stewardess is to dance.
The job of a Rockette.
I mean, the job of a Rockette is to dance.
In unison
that's all.
With other beautiful women with long legs. In a quasi military celebratory fashion.
But David, that was
that doesn't have anything to do with it's not a service profession. It's an entertainment profession where the job is beauty, long legs, and dancing ability.
That was the same argument that allowed the Rockettes to not let in anyone of color until 1987. That it was this uniform, you know, you didn't even want to see who they were, kind of thing. That's the kind of exact kind of argument someone would have made on the wrong side of history back then.
Well, is it your view, Noreen, that the Rockettes should be allowed to dance however they choose? That once you become a Rockette, it's like your choice as to how you perform and the way you perform and like whether you show up at performances?
No, that sounds like
a really crummy experience as an audience goer.
Listen, I hope in the future that the Rockettes are doing experimental dance numbers and really expanding their artistic repertoire. But I think that's a different argument.
Yeah, this argument is that just because you have to do a certain service, appear uniform, we're like opening up that fine line between uniform, Stepford, and as David says, like, you know, checking what so many people think is central right now at the door, which is their identity, their political affiliation, that you don't have to become completely anonymous to be part of a troupe, whether you're a cheerleader, whether you're a Rockette, whether you're a stewardess. That's just not realistic, what you're saying.
What about a soldier?
I don't think...
What about a soldier who refuses to do, to follow orders when he believes them to be essentially evil? Would you call him brave or would you call him,
They're two totally different environments. Like a soldier who refuses to follow orders to commit a war crime, is acting correctly and will be, you know, when the wheels of justice grind correctly.
No, not a war crime. War crime is not a fair analogy.
A soldier who refuses to obey, who refuses to show up because President Obama is speaking to his unit, and he refuses to show up because he is offended by President Obama, and that's violating an order from his commander, and he should be punished for it.
There were all those cops, remember, who turned against Obama right after his inauguration at some event. I guess that's sort of a similar analogy.
Which is exactly what America is designed to allow, right? That kind of protest.
But we're not asking for the Rockettes to be allowed to snub Trump or to give like a Meryl Streep type speech at the Trump inauguration. All we're saying is, was it okay for some of them to ask not to have to go to the inauguration? It wasn't disrespectful. It wasn't that they were going to wear a sign. They just didn't want to do it. There were plenty of Rockettes who were perfectly fine with it. You know, the Rockettes danced at the Bush inauguration. Like, they just didn't want to do it. And I'm saying that that should be fine. They shouldn't have a contract which forces them to do it. That's all.
I think it's totally fine for them to ask. And I don't know what their contract says. So if their contract says that they, you know, they have a right of conscience and that they can exercise it at any time, then by all
means, David, you're not backing down. We're going to call it a draw.
And unfortunately, the Christmas spectacular is over. You guys can't go see it and make a...
make our decision. Have any of you ever seen the Rockettes? That's the last question.
No.
No.
Yeah, I haven't seen them either. All right, well, let's all go together and see the Rockettes. All right, David, thank you for coming on. We'll continue it later.
See you guys.
Okay, let's move on to our next and last topic, chatbots. Kai and Siri and Alexa and Cortana. These are all bots or virtual assistants. There's also Julie. They're all very happy and eager to help you. Here's something that Julie, the inbox assistant, says as soon as you turn her on. I'm now at your disposal to process any calendar-related task you may delegate to me. I'm thrilled we can start working together. I cannot wait to respond to your first request. Okay, so Jacqueline Feldman in the New Yorker recently wrote about her new job helping to design a virtual assistant. And basically she was saying, you know, we just reflexively want them to be female because we like them better. They're less offensive and we naturally believe that they'll be subservient. Is that too strong a word, you guys think? Subservient or just helpful? Do you think just cheerful and helpful and pleasant is more accurate?
I think technically subservient is right? They're there to serve you.
Yeah, they're literally there to serve you. So first of all, do you guys have Siri set as a man or a woman?
I disabled Siri.
I've never used any of these.
I don't like the robots taking over, but that's another story.
Okay, what about your like Google Map? Do you have your Google Map set or like Waze or whatever it is you use? Do you generally trend towards women's voices or men's voices?
I didn't know you could choose.
Yeah, I use the default, which I think most people do in the default in America, but interestingly not a few other countries, is women. A woman's
voice.
Which
is weird. Like, we even want the women to give us directions, which is not what we normally want.
But hey, Hannah, that was sexist.
That was totally sexist, but I have the worst sense of direction of any human being, so I own that one. Okay, so what do you guys think? Let's break down the argument about why. I mean, there's a few reasons that these couple of writers who have written about it. One reason is just, secretaries and administrative assistants are still usually female, and so we kind of naturally think that these voices should be female. Right. One is just like a kind of crude reversion to stereotype that it has nothing to do with the reality of jobs. It has to do with the fact that, you know, deep in our reptile brains, we culturally just believe that like women are helpful and should be helpful.
I mean, this may sound weird and it may be idiosyncratic, but I just like interacting with women more generally. Like I prefer a woman doctor. I think I'd prefer like a woman lawyer. Speaking totally honestly, I think it's because in my like IRL life, I find conversations and relationships with women easier to navigate because you can use like flirtatiousness to like ease conflict and like.
But not with the robot assistant.
Well, no, but I feel like I'm just trained to dealing with women. I've been trained by my life to like dealing with women more than I like dealing with men, where there's like often a lot of sort of uncomfortable butting up against one another.
Yeah.
That is so interesting. That is really, really interesting. So flirtatiousness is used to ease conflict. Does it, like, what is...
But I think that's, like, I don't think that's, like, a... That may be just me. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of men actually prefer dealing with women in certain spheres. I don't know that they would say that they want a woman doctor or a woman lawyer, unfortunately. But I think that ease of conversation, I think men find women often easy to talk to.
Do you, woman, Noreen, is this... you know, offensive in some way? Like, is this irritating that men like to deal with us because we are, say, not like the way David Plotz just was in our former segment, which is like, you know, easily confrontational, you know, reflexively aggressive, and that raises the tension level. Like, dealing with us is just more, you know, ice skating. It's smooth and pleasant, and it doesn't bring up any conflict or tension.
Well, I would like to question the premise of the whole thing, which is that actually these virtual assistants are omniscient. They are godlike. They know everything. I think it's great that we've given them a woman's voice. And I think the sexism comes in when we assume that they are assistants and not like geniuses, you know? Is it...
That's the premise of the Hollywood movies. Like, that's where this naturally moves, is it comes back and bites you in the ass. Like, you assume that the women are pleasant and soothing and that you are in control of this situation, and then it starts to control you. Her and what's the other movie?
Her is such a good movie. I love that movie. It's the Spike Jonze movie.
Her is an amazing movie, but, you know, he's fallen. What's the other one where the bots, like, take over? The guy was the Silicon Valley genius, and, like, he builds these bots, and there's this weird sexual...
Ex Machina?
Yes, thank you. So her and Ex Machina, where he thinks he's in control, and that actually, her is a much more... you know, kind of pleasing and profound, amazing movie. Ex Machina is more, you know, science fiction horror, where what happens is exactly what you say, Noreen. He starts out building these beautiful, soothing, lovely, lovely bots, and then they, you know, they really take their revenge.
Well, it's interesting to think about, given what I think you're right, Noreen, but it's also, if you think about 2001 and the voice of Hal, the male voice of Hal, we find that much more scary and ominous, I think in part because it is a male voice. And if we have these assistants empowered, like we have empowered Siri and Alexa, then it may be the case that it's like that scariness goes down a little easier if it comes across in a female voice.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I do think there is something a little bit sexist about what's happening here. But this goes back to the question that we wrestle with every week in Slate Plus. Does the sexism matter deeply? And I think it actually might here if you know, the world becomes just all the more virtually assisted all the time. And all of the people, you know, who are this class of robot citizens are women. I think that might, in some insidious way, change the culture.
Jessica Nordell of the New Republic says exactly that, and it's what convinced me. She says, consistently representing digital assistants as female matters a lot in real life. It hard codes a connection between a woman's voice and subservience, which I actually think is our main problem in this world. You know? This either natural or culturally determined difference we have where we are assumed to be caretakey, all that research that shows, you know, how much it violates the norm and kind of triggers people's anxiety and resistance when women do anything that is either purely for themselves or aggressive on their own behalf, as opposed to defend someone else. Like, it's a problem that we consistently run into. So I do think it actually has consequences in real life.
It's also interesting. I don't remember which of the articles we were reading for this mentioned it, but it's interesting that a lot of these bots do effectively receive sexual harassment as a result of their gendered voice. That it's like they and that hasn't been the case when any of the AIs are programmed with a male voice.
Yeah, and Siri in particular, like, kind of flirts back. Actually, you might like Siri, David.
Do you think it's possible to imagine a future in which we're so comfortable with the idea of robots that we could have an AI voice that was genderless and therefore read as robot rather than as fake male or fake female?
What does
That's what Jacqueline Feldman was arguing for, that we should strive to create a third category, a they maybe, of robot voice that is neither, that we don't read as male or female, which Siri was supposed to be. If you ask Siri what her gender is, see, I said what her gender is, what its gender is, Siri replies, I am genderless like cacti and certain species of fish. But, you know, the other problem is that the Jacqueline Feldman was saying she thinks it's just because it's just reflexive because a lot of the people who design the chat bots are men and they just can't imagine it any other way, probably for the reasons David said. It's just like more frictionless for them to imagine a female voice. But she was saying it's kind of it's a thoughtless default. It doesn't need to be that way. Nobody's really trying very hard to create a genuinely gender-free virtual assistant.
It's possible to imagine a near future in which you can customize it to sound like a very particular person, right?
Like that's like have your mom give you directions all the time. Yeah. That seems so creepy.
Or like a particular famous person.
Right.
Oh, you can do that with Waze. You can have...
Like George Clooney give you directions?
Yeah, you can have like George Clooney give you directions. I tried that for a while and it wasn't, you know, it was. It's kind of annoying.
Was it a man or a woman that you tried it with?
It was a man. It was a rapper, and I can't remember which one. Like, my children, I mean, it's because, like, so my children reprogram when I'm not looking my various voices as lots of different things, or they make them call me different things, you know, because you can put your default name. So that's maybe why I've played around with these virtual assistants more than you guys have. It's, like, not by choice. It's just that's what they do. So I wake up, and it's like, you know, R. Kelly giving me directions or whoever it is that they've programmed to give me directions. It wasn't R. Kelly, but it was someone whose voice was just like R. Kelly's. So who would you program, David? Would it be your wife?
No, I think that would be a little weird. I think I'd probably not pick someone I actually knew, but pick like a famous person who I had some relative comfort with, but I don't know who that would be.
But do you want like a sexy Scarlett Johansson voice, or do you want like James Earl Jones, voice of God, giving you directions every time?
Well, there are those who would find James Earl Jones' voice sexy, right?
Sure.
Yeah. I think I would probably, if I had to pick right now, I would pick Juliette Lewis.
I don't know who that is.
There's like a slight lisp. I like a slight
That's
lisp.
A good one. I like that because she has like a bit of like vulnerability and sweetness to her. I can see that. Noreen, who would you pick?
June Thomas.
Good answer.
Interesting. That's a pretty good one.
Wouldn't she be great at doing voiceover work in that way?
Yeah, that's a really good one. You should suggest that June should become the next Siri.
June, if you're listening.
Yeah, I think I would pick Denzel Washington for my directions. You know, he has like a little bit of a sexy, pretty authoritative but not intimidating voice. Not for my personal assistant, but definitely for my, you know, directions person.
Who's your personal assistant?
Sorry, David. Who's my personal assistant? I need a minute to think about which woman would be. I think I would pick Rihanna as my personal assistant.
Oh wow!
Because she's like kind of badass. She would get you to do things, but she's girlfriendy. You know, she's like pretty girlfriendy. You feel like she's fun. I don't know that any of these things are true, obviously, but in my projections about Rihanna, and then she would, you know, she'd bought like wake up or, you know, you're going to miss your flight or whatever. Like I would believe her on certain things. I think that's who I'd pick, but she could also be like an intimate. This is embarrassing. It's like weird fangirl stuff.
No, that was such a glimpse into your soul. Yeah. I loved it.
All right. Well, listeners, that's a second task for you. Tell us who you would program as your personal assistant, male or female, famous, friend, whoever it is. Send us on Twitter, XXGabFest, or post on Facebook. Tell us who you would like to have as your personal assistant. All right. Well, let's move on to our recommendations. David, will you join us in recommending something?
I would love to recommend. This is really for you. I would like to recommend a new XX logo, one that features Noreen and June.
People hate our logo.
I mean, Megan and Emily, those are the other two people out there, right? They haven't been on the show for like several years, right?
That's true.
I would really appreciate a new drawing in which Hannah, Noreen, and June appeared. I would really.
Okay, here's. Can I ask you a different question? What do you think? Do you think it should be a drawing or a photograph? Because the updated thing is to have photographs. Like, I think the political Gabfest now has a photo of the three of them.
Oh, that, I
what
mean,
would you prefer?
I just want to see Noreen and June represented. I don't care in what form. I think probably a photo would be a little, feel a little more contemporary.
But this is the Rockettes. Like, we're just three anonymous women flapping our mouths at the same time. So, but okay, yes, that's a really good recommendation. I will go next. I have been forever, as you all know, looking for good mysteries. I can't really get into the mysteries, even though I want to. I think, you know, I'm of the age where I'm supposed to be reading mysteries, but I can't ever find any that I like. And I tried hard. And then I found one, which is the Tana French series, her novel In the Woods. It's set in Ireland, has a male and female detective couple. It's just so well written. And I read it on this long trip that I just took, and I thought that it was absolutely fabulous.
Cool.
So I recently moved into a new apartment, and miracle of miracles in New York City, it has a really big kitchen, which is basically why I rented it. I've been on a real sort of cooking kick, and I have two books to recommend that are not quite cookbooks, but sort of. One is the terribly named Cooking for Mr. Latte by Amanda Hesser, who used to work at the New York Times and now runs Food 52, which is a great crowdsourced recipe website. And it's a story of essentially her courtship of her now husband, who was not into food when they met. And it's kind of like almost a social diary told through the meals that she prepared and ate and her thinking around food at that time. And she's a really nice, breezy writer, and it's fun and quick to read. And then the other one I haven't finished yet, but I'm totally in love with, is called The Everlasting Meal by Tamar Adler, who now writes a column for The New York Times. And it's just really beautifully written. It's almost like a philosophy of cooking more than anything else. It's like, okay, here's how you start with boiling water. And this is all the things that you can do with boiled water. And here's how you plan your week of roasting. And she's like she literally worked at Alice Waters' restaurant. So she's in that, you know, simple food is beautiful food kind of school. But if you like to cook and you like to eat, it's a really beautiful book.
This is such a male recommendation, I think, but do you know the Food Lab?
The Kenji whatever. Yeah. That is exactly the opposite of how I like to cook. Like the thing that I really like about this Tamar Adler book is that it's like it teaches you the chords or something, and then you can play jazz yourself, which is how I like to cook, rather than like, you know, I hate the Cook's Illustrated School of Cooking where you measure everything precisely, which is my impression of what the Food Lab is, right? Like, it's very precise and scientific and...
Yeah, it's sort of. There's some improvisation involved, but yeah, it's like about mastering like particular... Yeah, strategies and techniques.
Well, this is that kind of thing, but I think in a different tone, I would say. And I got this title slightly wrong. It's An Everlasting Meal, Cooking with Economy and Grace.
I know this is out of turn, but can I make a second recommendation? This was just so freaking good. I can't stand it. I was part of my reporting trip. This week, included long, long drives across Florida. And so I listened to this podcast called In the Dark, which is by Madeline Barron. It's APM, so they're like an investigative podcast network. And it's about the disappearance of Jacob Wetterling, famous disappearance case a couple of decades ago. It is so freaking good. I'm allergic to like murder porn. Like I hate there's all these new podcasts, which is like my favorite murder. I just find that all like weird and voyeuristic and gross. And so I was worried about this one. Like, was this just going to be more murder porn? It is not. It builds to such an amazing point. It has such a larger story to tell about America and American culture. It is insanely well reported and investigated. I think it's like better than Serial. It's just so gripping and it goes to places that you never expected it to go. And the point is not just like, oh, this particular case is messed up. It's just like all the implications that this case had. It is so good. I loved it so much.
I just subscribed while you were talking.
Oh, it's so freaking good. I mean, it's several episodes, so you have to sort of start from, you know, you have to really make it through the whole, you have to just keep going. But it just gets better and better and better. Like, every episode is better than the next one. It's so good. So thank you, Madeline Barron, for making this amazing podcast. Okay, that's our show for today. Thanks to our producer, Verilyn Williams, the executive producer of Slate Podcast, Steve Lickteig. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and our wonderful intern, Daniel Schrader. The Double X Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. You can check out the entire roster at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page for more information about this show and our recommendations, slate.com/xx. Facebook is facebook.com/XXGabFest. To answer my questions or to make comments or recommend topics, email us at XXGabFest@slate.com or Twitter, XXGabFest. We appreciate the Twitter. We all do a lot more Twitter, I think. So Twitter is good. It's a good place to reach us. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us, which allows other people to find out about the show. For David and Noreen, I am Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks. Lovers wanna love. I don't even want none of the above. I want to piss on you. Piss on you. I'll piss on you. I'll pee on you. Won't you braid my hair?